You are listening to the Bad Duo back in style. We might be joined by a third. This is Punk News Podcast number 228. Punk News Podcast. This is Features Editor Johnny G, and we're at least starting off as one of my favorite kind of podcasts. Just me and my main man, my compadre in action, the good, the bad, no ugly. We are here with Managing Editor Adam White. Just you and me this week, Adam White, kicking it down, shooting the shit, slapping fives, playing pinball, crank calling, just bro-ing down, baby.
Drinking eggnog in this case.
I'm drinking half and half iced tea. Have you ever had that?
No. Like, what is it? Like, is that a booze thing?
No. It's half iced tea, half lemonade.
It's not like a Long Island iced tea thing.
No, it's not. It's technically called an Arnold Palmer, if you will. But I think that name is trademarked. So I'm having an honest tea, half and half.
Now, is this iced tea that is... That is sweetened? Well, I guess there's lemonade in it, so it would make it sweetened. I'm always unsure of this. Canadians are very unsure of what we get when we come to the States for iced tea.
Yeah, well,
not that we come to the States for iced tea.
There's actually technically two. Let's talk about this, because my favorite beverage is iced tea, and I love iced tea. And some people say iced tea, and some people say iced tea. Iced tea is more of like a Philadelphia regional thing. I think maybe New York, too. Other places, it's iced tea. But there's sweet tea. And sun tea and iced tea, and they're all slightly different.
Okay, so from my perspective, we would call it iced with a D.
Mm-hmm.
If you go anywhere in Canada and get iced tea, you're getting what is basically what I assume is like black tea, like orange pekoe tea that has been sweetened. So there's sugar in that shit.
But is it cold?
It's cold. Yeah, it's cold, but, and it's sweetened, but it's sweetened to the point where it's like it's basically like a soft drink. It's not carbonated, but it's sweet.
But the key factor is how it's sweetened, and that's the two different families of iced tea.
Okay, so in the Canadian case, if you go into like a restaurant and you order a glass of iced tea, it's probably sweetened via some disgusting bag of like industrial restaurant crap that they goop into the drink. It's probably made just like they make Coke, where there's like. Where, like, you know, from their food supplier, they get some sort of, like, you know, basically, like, human body bag full of tar, and they put that into a machine, and then it barfs out Coke. It's probably that sort of thing, except tea. I actually much prefer the way that you folks do it. Well, at least not you folks, these Americans where I've been. Because when Canadians go to the U.S. for the first time, and if they're in a restaurant or something like that, and they order an iced tea, at least in my experience, I would always get a cold, unsweetened tea.
Yes.
And I actually prefer that, but I'm not a sweet tooth guy. And I like that quite a bit. Now, you don't get it up here.
Well, see, that's iced tea as opposed to sun tea. And here's the difference. Sun tea, and that's a southern thing, and that's a little too sweet for my taste, is what they do is they boil hot water with tons of sugar in it, and then they add the tea bags, and then they pour that over ice. That's sweet tea, and that's very, very sweet. There's two types of iced tea. Well, there's iced tea and there's sun tea. Sun tea is my favorite. Sun tea is where you take tea bags, you put them in a big jug of room temperature, and you let it sit out in the sun for 3 or 4 hours. Then you take that and you add sugar and lemon to your preference. That's sun tea, and that's the tastiest. But then there's also iced tea, which is where you heat up tea like you normally do, chill it down, serve it, and then put sugar in it as you please.
Yeah, you see, I would much prefer the as you please than the kind of like gross industrial kind that we get.
Like Brisk.
Oh, fuck Brisk, man. Okay, it's good that you have that because I hate it. So here's the thing about Brisk. To me...
Welcome to the Punk News Podcast.
Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. We're talking about iced tea tonight. Here's the thing about Brisk. you can go to most restaurants around here and you could get an iced tea, and it's going to basically taste the same because it's probably whatever, like, the iced tea pre-made goop variant is that they get from, like, you know, Coca-Cola or Pepsi or whoever actually provides them with their beverages. But if it's brisk, to me, it tastes like they took one of those, watered it down a little bit, and then mixed it with, like, pieces of shaved tinfoil. And that's what brisk tastes like to me. It's fucking disgusting.
It was nasty shit. And plus, they carbonate it, at least in the States.
Oh, see, they don't carbonate it here, but it's gross.
Oh, man, brisk is so bad. Screw brisk. Anyways, let's talk about Joe Strummer.
Don't people tune in to find out our opinions on regional beverage differences?
Not only that, regional iced tea differences. Joe Strummer died 13 years ago. So, I mean, like, this is not a big anniversary or whatever, but, you know, it's nice to, you know, continually remember Joe and Mick Jones, who's still alive, of course, and Paul and Topper and all the guys, and Keith Levine and Rat Scabies who was the other drummer? What the hell's the name of the other drummer in the Clash?
Terry Grimes.
Terry Grimes. Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, Adam, just a little while ago, you and I were on a podcast, Everything in the Kitchen Sink, where we talked about Joe Strummer for 2 hours, literally.
Yeah. If anyone is actually interested in hearing us not talk about iced tea, if you go to eatks.net, so EATKS.net, you can find the episode that we were on. And yeah, it was fun. We got on Nikki's show and we played like Joe Strummer rarities and we, you know, talked about the Clash for like 2 hours. And, I think we're gonna do another one in the new year too. So yeah, that was really fun. And there's lots of music on there. So it's not just like chit chat too. So that's reason enough to go listen to it.
You know, Nikki's. Most of our listeners have heard all the Clash classics, all the Joe Strummer classics. Adam, what is the rare Clash or the rare Joe Strummer track the kids should go check out?
This seems super obvious to me, but I think that if you've only heard the U.S. version of the first Clash record, it really, you should go seek out the U.K. version, because I think it's, you know, while it's missing some tracks that have become super classics, I think it's a more interesting document of who that band was, and you get to hear cool songs that aren't on the U.S. version, like Protex Blue. So and we talked about that in the last show. This is like the Protex Blue podcast.
You know, we're talking about condoms, iced tea, and condoms. Welcome to the punk.
Yeah.
Podcast.
Okay. So anyway, the rare stuff that I've always been a huge. I'm going to call this stuff rare now because I don't think you can buy this anymore, but I'm sure you can get it used everywhere. But I was a big fan of Black Market Clash and Super Black Market Clash and all of those sort of like singles, B-sides that ended up collected on those records, and all the sort of weird stuff that doesn't even really, that never makes it onto the greatest hits collections or anything like that. Stuff like the Magnificent Dance and stuff like that, where it's just like them doing dub and weird funky stuff. I appreciate all that. I'm a Sandinista fan though, so I appreciate all that too. As for a specific track though, that is a really good question.
I gotta say, Adam White, your pick of Black Market Clash is great, because maybe my favorite Clash track is it's the Salute to Jamaican Culture, the Armageddon time that blends into the dub version of Kick It Over on Black Market Clash, so like the 7 or 8 minute version of Armageddon Time. Amazing. That's also on the B-side of the London Calling 12-inch. Maybe the best Clash tune. Super heavy, super long, super experimental. It's a hot track. Good pick, yeah. Adam White.
You know what? There's a lot on Black Market Clash that is great. I mean, there's the Pressure Drop cover is on there. City of the Dead has always been kind of one of my favorite Clash songs for some reason or another. There is their cover of
is Time Bank is Robber Tight on that?
I mean, Bank Robber's on that. Yeah, oh. I think it is. Time is Tight. Their cover of Booker T and the MGs is on there. Bank Robber's on there. Also, the Robber Dub is on there.
Are they put together? I gotta check this.
Yeah,
out.
They're put together with the Mickey Dredd.
Mickey Dredd. I take it all back. That's my favorite Clash tune. Bank Robber blended in the Robber Dub. You gotta check that out, Punk News kids. You have got to check that out.
But that set though was different than it was. I think it was pretty significantly different than Super Black Market Clash.
Right.
Because I think Super Black Market, and I'm just pulling it up right here.
Wow, you're right. Super Black Market Clash chops Bank Robber and Robber Dub up into two tracks, and it's just Robber Dub. You got to have them together. You got to have them together.
There's a different set of stuff on there. Now, there's some cool stuff that's on Super, like Gates of the West, right? Basically, they spliced in the stuff from the Cost of Living EP onto there. But I don't know. It's a weird set. Now, I'm pretty sure that none of that is in print anymore, and they knocked that all off once the various sets of greatest hits compilations in the past decade or so came out. But you've got to be able to just walk into any used CD store and find one or both of those records, though.
Well, you could definitely find the CD version, but I got to say, if you can find an original version of Black Market Clash with the Bank Robber and Robber Dub blended together, that is a hot track, man. And also, Armageddon Time of Justice Tonight is longer on that version, too. It's an 11-minute version as opposed to the Justice Tonight version, which is 9 minutes on Super Black Market Clash.
I'm just trying to dig up the vinyl here because it was super interesting for me to find when I was a kid, but it is super useless in a way. And hold on, I'm just trying to figure out what it is. It was it was a 10-inch or a 12 or a extended.
Actually, I'm glad you mentioned this. I really regret this. Is Black Market Clash is a 10-inch, and a little while ago I saw a 12-inch version, and it was only $10. I'm like, hey, I already have it. I mean, I don't need it just to buy it as a 12-inch. I think it was a bootleg or a super duper rare version. I so regret not buying the 12-inch version of Black Market Clash.
All right, so this is the part of the show where I delay while I dig through this stack hold on. What is this? So I have this, like, it's an EP. I mean, it's a 12-inch called... What is this thing called here? So it says the 598 series, the Clash Present Radio Clash, especially priced EP. So it's this incredibly thin, actually, piece of vinyl here. So on the one side of it is, you know, Radio Clash. On the one side of it, there's two mixes of Radio Clash. One is listed as This Is Radio Clash, and the second one is listed as Radio Clash. The B-side of this record has something called Outside Broadcast and something called Radio 5. And I'm pretty sure, having listened to this not too long ago, they're both just, like, super weird riffs on top of the Radio Clash beat. It's the kind of thing that we're going to play on one of these upcoming podcasts, because, like, it's not the kind of thing that's like, oh, man, this is a cool song. It's like, wow, this is the band fucking around, right? But
that can be fun, though, man. I love it. I kind of like it's super fun on a B-side when a band just screwing around, you know?
You know what? And speaking of bands just screwing around for 17 minutes, we have two of those to talk about.
Let's talk about them right now. Let's do it.
Yeah, so the one I'm going to say is... Okay, neither of these super engaged me, especially because I didn't have a lot of time to prep for this show. And I was like, oh, man, I have like half an hour to do my podcast prep, and I have two 17-minute songs to listen to in that time. So the first is from Fucked Up. Now, they... Their Canadian label Arts and Crafts just released this sucker online, so we don't know if this is actually ever going to have a proper release or anything like that. It's called what do you want to call it? Like Voca Rubata?
Oh, I think it's
Rubata.
Oh, the song, it's Voce Rubata.
It's
Italian. Let me check it out here.
Yeah, I'm Italian, but I can't speak it.
Voce Rubata is what it is.
Voce Rubata, sure. Anyways, so it is 17 minutes long. It is mostly kind of like a classic piano and opera vocals from people in the Canadian Opera Company. If no one was to tell you that it was a Fucked Up project, it would just sound like this weird opera thing. So that's the one. And that sucker's 17 minutes long. The other one comes from, of all people, The Replacements. So the Mats recorded a song called... Okay, well, they didn't record a song. The Mats recorded 24 minutes of noodling around in the studio and then released it on SoundCloud and called it Poke Me in My Cage. It's basically completely improvised. And... You can endure that sucker on SoundCloud there. I say this disparagingly, being a huge Replacements fan, but that was a waste of my time. I don't know about you.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not a huge Replacements fan. I'm not anti, but I think this is kind of in this exemplifies the Replacements to a T. The reason why the Replacements have always been so critically adored is because they're able to balance normal or normal-ish pop, rock, slash punk songs with just screwing off interesting things and being a complete mess. Rock critics and even fans love bands that are an absolute mess. The critics never love a band that is a well-functioning band that doesn't argue or screw around. They love bands that can sometimes be great and sometimes are terrible. If people remember, in the 80s, when you went to see the Replacements, it wasn't a sure thing by any means. They might show up completely wasted and not play, or they might do an all Rolling Stones set, or they might, you know, just do a 5-minute set, or they might do a 3-hour set. That's just the kind of band they were. And so I guess that's part of the fun of the band, is when you go check them out, you're never quite sure what you're going to get. And honestly, that's my favorite kind of band, when they do it well. That being said, this is just the band screwing around. I don't know if the band is going to try to position this as some, you know, super clever statement or some great avant-garde music. To me, it's just junk. It's not tactical. It's just them screwing around. And almost, I wonder if they're doing what they used to do in like the late 80s and early 90s, just giving out junk and just seeing if people will bite into it. Like, if you read interviews with the band about their last few albums, they openly admit that a lot of the songs they wrote were just crap, and they just threw them on just to throw them on. The funny thing is, though, is fans can never seem to agree which songs are crap and which ones aren't. Unlike, say, the Clash, you know, where almost everybody agrees that, what's the name of the last album? I can't remember. This is crap.
Cut the crap.
This is crap. Cut the Crap is bad. Everybody agrees that it's bad, you know? So I think that's what this is. And even now, I saw a lot of people online are like, oh, this song's so great. And you and me, Adam, I like to think of myself as a pretty artistically inclined guy, but this just sounds like kind of crap.
It sounds like noodling to me. I mean, like, you know, when you're listening to something that's long and meant to be long, and I'm okay with that. I'm always on here talking about keeping songs short. And let me tell you, I'm going to get to one of those in a minute. But I'm usually okay with something being long if it's written that way. So, like, any of, like, the fucked up You're the Zodiac.
You're the Dragon!
Yeah. Like, those are cool. I'm cool with those. They're long. They're supposed to be long. It works for me. Like shit, like, I could listen to Marquee Moon on a loop, right? And that's such Chuckers 11 minutes long. So I'm good with long stuff, as long as there's some sense of purpose. This just seems to be, you know, it's them just fucking around in the studio, which is entirely cool, and bands need to do that. I don't necessarily need to devote 24 minutes to listening to it, I guess, is the point. But you know what? It's not their release. They just chucked it on SoundCloud. You know, diehard fans that just want to hear them doing anything are going to be into it, I guess. So that's cool. I guess that's what things like SoundCloud are for. So, the fucked up thing.
Let's talk about the Replacements for one more minute, Adam. Does the band think this is like a great, interesting musical thing, or is this just them being funny or pulling a gag to see if people will say it's good?
I bet you the amount of thought was the guy in the studio was like, hey guys, they recorded all that, and then Paul was like, put it on the internet. And that was it. Or it's like, Paul, what's the title? And he's like, I don't know, Poke Me in My Cage. What's that mean? I don't know.
It's a cool title. I'll give him that.
Yeah, so the title is far more evocative of anything than the song is. So on the other hand, the fucked up one, this one was definitely done with purpose, I'm sure. It was written by someone. It's not, I don't think you can just like improv noodle around if you have an opera singer. That said, my disclaimer on this is that I only had like 6 to 7 minutes to jump through this song at various points and figure out what was going on in it. It didn't strike me as a thing that, you know, I'd be rushing out to buy the 10-inch of, because it's opera over piano. But hey, maybe I missed the cool part. I don't know. I respect them for doing all kinds of arty shit. I mean, that's fine. It's just like, this isn't my bag, really.
What'd you think of the rap section?
I miss the rap section. Oh, right. Was there a rap section?
Yeah, yeah, about halfway through.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, see, this is what happens when I'm jumping around.
How about the disco part? Did you like the disco part?
You're making shit up. There is no rap part or disco part.
I thought this was cool. I'm not gonna lie and say, oh yeah, man, this really spoke to me. I need to get into jazz and I need to get into opera. And I've been saying that for like the past 5 years or more, and I still haven't done it.
This is interesting because I can get into jazz.
If you would, Adam.
Not in the sense that like I'm rushing out and buying jazz records or anything like that. Although I have some Oscar Peterson stuff because we're required to do that as Canadians. It's sort of like in our constitution here. But with a good friend of mine who I went to college with, you know, we would go to like a jazz festival when it was in town and just like, you know,
really
hang out. Yeah, because you'd go and you'd hang out and you'd drink and you'd watch, you know, some crazy musicians doing some crazy stuff on stage, and then you clap, and then it was a good time.
Did you wear a beret?
I did not get a beret, no. But like, I mean, there was actually a we don't go to it anymore because it got way too basically we got pushed out because we're the riffraff. So I live in wine country here, so there's this jazz in the winery thing that happened every year where you could go get into this park, or this park was like the winery. It was like the vineyard, right? Yeah, you go into the vineyard, there'd be a stage, they'd have like five or six different acts would come up and play jazz on stage, and you'd sit there in the sun and drink entire bottles of wine and eat like a picnic that you brought. And it was great. But it was one of these things, and this is where the jazz world and the punk world really diverge, is it was one of these things that like the first few years you went, you could just like go and bring like a, bring your picnic stuff and like some chairs and an umbrella or whatever, and, you know, sit down and do your thing. Then as years went on and this became more popular, it was like, we've sectioned off this whole area to sell the premium people. So if you general admission fools want to do this, you can go, you know, sit on the pavement between these two buildings. so we got outclassed. We're like, we can't afford this shit anymore because, there was no Fugazi mentality for the jazz and the winery. Let me tell you, no one was worried about keeping that a $5 show. So anyways. But opera, I have no, it's not something I disparage. I just have no literacy in it. Like I turn it on and I'm like, this sounds like things that I heard Bugs Bunny making fun of.
I don't quite get opera, but I think I get opera more than I get jazz, particularly because it has like stories and vocals, you know? I do like big soaring voices, but back regard to this is, I'm going to try to explore this track more. I love that with F'd Up, like The Replacements, but kind of better, in that you never know what they're going to do next, and it's always something interesting. It might not always be your favorite tune, but it's always something worth giving time to. You know?
Yeah, I agree completely, and that's what's cool about it. So what I want to seg from this is I want to seg into one of the songs that we wanted to talk about that came out this past week, because It's on the other end of the spectrum for me in that, well, I'll just get right into it. So the Sidekicks have released a new tune. It's called Summer Brings You Closer to Satan, which is an amazing title. And it's from their upcoming album, Runners in the Nerved World, which is due out on January 20th, 2015. I believe on Epitaph. Is it on Epitaph?
The Sidekicks?
Yeah.
I believe it Epitaph.
Yeah.
Is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So. Now, I like the Sidekicks, and I like them despite the fact that I'm not totally into a lot of bands that have this sound, and I don't know exactly what it is. Their album Weight of Air from a few years ago was one of the top punk news albums of the year. It might have been the top punk news album of the year. I really like that, and I still like it a lot. The first track from this record was called Jesus Christ Supermalls, which was also a cool title. Anyways,
I hate puns and titles.
This one with that, I like that one. It was kind of cool. Anyways, though, I generally do too. But that song was cool. I was into that. This song is one of these ones where I was listening to this, and I was into it. And then at around 2 minutes into the song, where, in my opinion, the song should stop, they go into this kind of like extended bridge, and then they bring the chorus back in once more. And then at the end of that, they do some like guitar noodling at the end. And then by the time they're done, this is a 3 minute, 40 second song. Now, if you're doing something crazy, to me, going to that length is fine. If you're doing something that has like a lot of propulsion to it, that's really going to support that, sure. But in this case, this being sort of a really light pop song, once they get to that 2 minute mark in this song, to me, like, you know, they've done like it's verse, chorus, and like we're done, we're cool. Like this is classic pop song stops now time. But then they don't. They go into this. I don't know. They keep going with it. And I think that if they did that live, I would be like, and I was a fan of this stuff, and I was, let's say they released this as a 2 minute version, but then live they played this like it's recorded, I'd be totally into it, because I'd be like, oh, this is a cool thing that they're doing with this song, extending it out. I'm into it. I'm digging this. But I don't know. There's something about this on record where on a recording where, you know, like I hear this, and then by the end of the song, I'm just kind of like, eh. Like I was into this for a couple minutes, but now it's just sort of still going. And like, and there's a hook, but there's not so much of a hook that I'm like, yes, more. You can't possibly get this any other way than to keep this song going, right? And it's one of these ones that does it for me. And it's the thing that turns me off of these type of bands when I actually hear their records. Because I go to sit down, I'm like, yeah, you know what? This is a tight little pop band. You know, I'm cool with that. Let's listen to some tight little pop songs. And then the record ends up being like 40 minutes long. And you're like, and it just pushes me away from it. That's my opinion. That's the opposite end of this length spectrum for me.
Adam, let's investigate this further. Query, do you like Pavement and Spoon?
That was me breaking to drink some of this eggnog that I have.
You put ice in your eggnog?
I did, because I put whiskey in this eggnog and I put ice in the whiskey. And anyways, it's a long story. It involves ice, whiskey, and eggnog. I basically told the whole story. That was it. So Pavement and Spoon. I like Pavement quite a bit. I am a super late into Pavement person. I probably started listening to Pavement literally a year and a half ago. I knew they were incredibly influential. I know everyone always talked about Pavement. They were just one of those bands that, like, when everyone in our musical universe was talking about the bands that influenced them, and people were like, oh yeah, okay, well, I was influenced by like Pavement and the Replacements and the Pixies and blah blah blah, I went and I listened to the Pixies and the Replacements, and just Pavement, I was just like, yeah, yeah, I'll get to them, and I never did. But I have recently, so you know, like, I'm cool with Pavement. I like it. Spoon, this makes me sound like I'm a total musical ignoramus, but Spoon, I only started listening to 6 months ago. And I only started listening to their new record, which, by the way, I think is cool. It's on my top 20 list for this year. I thought it was groovy. Mm. That said, I have nothing to compare it to, so I have no Spoon literacy. I don't know if that's what that band always sounds like. I don't know if everyone hates them now. I don't know anything. I just kind of like that record. Now, those bands, I think I know where you're going with this. Those bands play longer songs.
Yes, but not only do those bands play longer songs, those bands focus more on texture and, I want to say, intensity than they do on riffs, which is where I come from, and I think where you sort of come from as well.
Yeah, so to me, whenever I'm listening to one of those bands, it's like a nice diversion for me. It's a bit of a, like, whenever I'm listening to one of these texture bands, it's kind of like, I know it's not where I'm gonna, you know, it's not where I'm gonna go, you know, set up camp. It's not where I'm gonna live and plant my flag and say, you know, this is my music. But I like going to those kind of bands as like a kind of interesting diversion from the kind of stuff that I normally listen to. you know, in the same way that, like, you know, like, I really like, you know, like, Loveless by My Bloody Valentine doesn't mean I'm going to go listen to, like, 400 shoegaze records, but it means that, you know, that record is cool. I can dig it. So those bands are kind of the same way for me, is that, you know what, the top 20 list is a good example of this. In the 20 records that I'm listening to in a given year, you know, and the fact that a bunch of them are bands that either are bands like Off or bands that sound like the Ramones or something like that, I'm cool with one or two, you know, atmospheric-y things, textured things in my mix. But it's not my main animal by any means.
And I think that's what's representative of the Sidekicks and a lot of these, you know, really popular bands right now. Bands like Chumped, bands like even like Kayatana, bands like Waxahachie. There's a great focus on texture and evolving melody, if you will, then there is riffage and banging it out. And that's usually what I find most interesting about music. I don't know what that says. I don't know if it's a fad or if it has something to do with a generational gap, but I think that's definitely representative of this kind of music. That being said, I was not a huge Sidekicks fan before. I did kind of dig at least the first half of this. Honestly, this reminded me of like power pop and Cheap Trick, to tell you the truth, particularly the vocals.
Yeah, it is, but it's not tough.
It's not tough.
And I think that's kind of what I like it. Like, if they were doing this as like straight arena rock, I wouldn't like it at all. But the fact that this kind of sounds like a kid that you could beat up singing this song, I think it's kind of endearing. Not that I'm a tough guy, but it's even more, you know, it kind of has that charm to it. And that's what I've always kind of liked about this band, is that they sound, I mean, I don't want to say weak, but they sound like there's like a vulnerability.
You really sound this band. They're weak. No, I can beat them up. Their songs are too long.
No, there's a vulnerability that I think is kind of cool to this band. And it comes across a little bit in the production and in the way that they approach these songs, and that they're not making them into giant pop songs. Even though, you know, if you were to say, like, look at the music on paper or look at the lyrics on paper, like, they could be. And I guess that's one of the things that I kind of dig about them. So I don't want to bang on this too much. I just think it's an interesting counterpoint to our length discussion there. But it's, you know, there's the Sidekick song is out there. I'm still kind of looking forward to this record. I'm a little bit worried it's a record that I'm going to get tired of before I'm done the record. And I guess that's what my concern is here.
Well, speaking of getting tired, Adam, hit him with a song that they won't get tired with listening to.
Okay, so We're gonna play a song. This is gonna be slightly related to the ongoing theme that seems to be happening in all the songs that I've been playing over the past handful of podcasts, which is, this is a Toronto band that is involved in the Toronto noise rock scene that is related to Buzz Records. So this band here is called Dilly Dally. Now, they have a 7-inch that they just put out on Fat Possum out of Oxford, Mississippi, and the 7-inch that I put out, is the song is called Candy Mountain. The B-side is Green, and we're going to play the song Green for you. This came out on October 14th in 2014 on Fat Possum. So the A-side of this record, it's aggressive. It's a little bit unhinged. Green's a little bit more subdued, but it's completely weird in the way that this band is. So this is a band fronted by a girl named Katie Monks. She clearly has an affection for a really sloppy version of grunge, of the kind of stuff that wasn't super popular during the grunge era, but the kind of stuff that all those grunge guys would have listened to. So it's there's melody in there, but it's abrasive, and there's just some shrieking on top of some really kind of like some dirty guitar work and everything. So it's really cool. So this song is called Green. The band is Dilly Dally. You want to find more info on this, the best place to go, and actually to pick up the EP, would be go to Fat Possum Records. So here you go.
Hey, everybody. Greg Simpson, a.k.a. Greg Orb, here. And the track I'm going to play for you is by Eric Ayotte. He's a cool guy who plays kind of a cross between folk punk and just plain old indie rock. Good, mostly acoustic-based stuff. And with this album called Transparency, it's backed pretty much through the entire album with a full band. And the track I'm going to play for you is called Get to Stepping. You can check him out at Eric Ayotte. That's ericayotte.bandcamp.com. You can also check out the full review I wrote on Transparency, which went up on Punk News a little while ago. So just search for that. And here it is, Eric Ayotte.
Talk about something that I'm down with, something that I love that no one else does apparently. Jesse Michaels, he's put out his third short film. It's called Exploring, and this is how Jesse Michaels explains it. He says the film was very loosely patterned after the girls' Sex in the City's 80s sitcom. Three women move to the city only to encounter street scum. What will they do? The answer will terrify, disgust, shock, and ultimately arouse you. And it has the movie has a brand new theme song sung by Jesse Michaels. I love this. I'll dig into this first, and then Adam, you can respond. First of all, I love the theme song. It's a reference to a Love and Spoonful song, and I just thought it was hilarious. Now, a lot of people have attacked Jesse Michaels' short films. They've said either that, you know, it's weird or doesn't make any sense, or that it's too quirky or too weird, too strange, but I mean, that's kind of the point. People don't seem to understand how to approach this, and I think what people are hoping for is a key that explains everything in these films. But you're not going to find that. These kinds of films are not the kind of thing that say, "Oh, well, if you approach from this angle, then everything in it makes sense." I think, first of all, as he said, he's just doing it to be funny, and there's a lot of funny stuff in here. But it's not just yucks. There's also, like, a lot of strange experimentation. Like, at one point, Michaels distorts somebody's voice for no apparent reason. At another point, it just stops, and there's, like, strange sound effects. At another point, he dubs his own voice over some of the actors. And, and again, we have people spitting paint in people's faces, which is a recurring theme for his films. The way, I think, to approach this is that you shouldn't ask why are these characters speaking in weird voices, or why do they have weird names, or why do they speak in such weird cadences. I think a better way to approach it is why not, and that it's almost just, well, it is an experiment. It's saying, what if we do weird stuff here? What if we do strange stuff here? It's not necessarily made for one any final point. Well, not to be cliche, but to me, these videos are more about the journey than the destination. It's what happens if this what happens if this weird thing happens, or this strange thing? How can we interpret it? How can we enjoy it? And people have said, John, you're being pretentious. Or I don't think it's pretentious. I think it's the opposite of pretentious. I think it's the ability to have fun and indulge in whimsy without, you know, any structural demands as created by a genre. And when I say that, I think a lot of people approaching this and say, well, a funny movie has to have these elements. An experimental movie has to have these elements. These kind of have them all, and I just find them delightful. I think they're hilarious, clever, and I really like the hidden jokes and hidden weirdness layered between them. Adam, am I overanalyzing this? Do I really not get it, and the kids that hate it are right? Or am I right in that it's a thing of whimsy and experimentation, and the kids should work on broadening their horizons? That's not a loaded question, but it's a loaded question.
I think that there is a certain, really a certain almost punk rock tradition to doing weird for the sake of weird things, videos included. And I'm fully supportive of this thing that Jesse is up to. That's cool. My opinion of the actual work aside, I'm totally cool with this roadie's going down, you know, by all means, whatever. I think that the kids are reacting in the way that I am. I'd almost expect them to react, because there's not a lot that's involved in music fandom these days, punk rock fandom in particular, that goes weird like this.
Right, and that's my big problem with the punk. Adam, you just underscored my entire issue with the current punk rock scene. Not enough weirdness.
Yeah, so there's not necessarily a... I don't want to say that, like, oh, the kids that don't like this don't get it, but I want to say that the kids that are overly critical that this exists in the first place are missing the fact that there should be some embracing of the weird for weird's sake. Not necessarily that means you got to like it, but it means you got to step back and go, like, you know, Jesse, you crazy bastard, I don't know what the fuck that was, but good for you, right? Like, at least kind of take that opinion of it. Now, the one thing that I'm kind of shocked about, though, is I was just looking at the actual YouTube page that this came on, and there's two comments from Jesse under the video. Now, the one comment, and I this must be a joke, because these are all commented with the same name as the person that posted the video, is... Amazing. I just watched this on YouTube. I am in no way involved with the production, and I am floored. Sure, it's just a short, but this thing changed the way I feel about movies and myself. Amazing. Brilliant. Perfect. Anyways, that's Jesse fucking around. But the other thing that he posted, and I'm surprised that he did this, because I'm surprised that he felt the need to explain it, is he said, "Dear friends, I know not everybody gets the humor in these shorts. The best way to explain it is in the vein of Tim and Eric, David Lynch, the funny aspect of his work, and older John Waters movies. The absurdity is meant to be funny, and the jokes play off the general weirdness. Anyways, if you do like it, please share it on Facebook. These are basically promoted through social media. For anyone who cares, I am now moving on to a more professional production and more serious subject matter, but truthfully, I love doing absurd shorts. Thank you very much for watching this." I'm surprised that Jesse did that.
I'm not.
Because if you're going for weird, just let it be weird. And the people that aren't going to get it, like, I don't feel that, like, I don't. I guess he didn't need to apologize to anyone if they don't get it.
I think that betrays who Jesse Michaels is, and I could be wrong. I mean, I'm not. I've never hung out with Jesse Michaels. I've never had a deep, extended conversation with Jesse Michaels. But I think pretty much everyone in the punk rock world agrees that Jesse Michaels is perhaps a genius, if not a genius, then a supreme talent or a very great talent. True?
I think that is a general opinion, yes.
And I think Jesse Michaels, as an artist, and I think most people would agree with me, if people read his lyrics, I think they'll see he's kind of a step above most artists in the way he approaches things, the way he phrases things. I think he's an exceptional talent, with an ability greater than most other punk rock artists or even most other artists. And with that, I think, comes a very raw sensitivity. I think that, let me just use Black Dahlia as an example. If you say to Black Dahlia, you suck, it's really not going to ruin his day because Black Dahlia knows he rocks, and Black Dahlia knows no one can do what Black Dahlia can do, right? More or less. I mean, no one likes being told they suck, but Black Dahlia can shake it off because, you know, he's in the Dwarves. He's in one of the greatest punk rock bands ever. If you said to Jesse Michaels, I think this video is stupid. I think that would actually hurt him or bother him or at least cause him to ponder on that for an extended period of time. See, his thing is almost an apology. He's saying, if you don't get it, I'm sorry. I'll do more professional things in the future so you won't be burdened by my weirdness, you see. And I think that betrays that he's very sensitive and very raw and that maybe he doesn't realize that he is an exceptional talent, and that, if people criticize him, it doesn't matter because he's Jesse Michaels. Operation Ivy, Classics of Love, even these films, which I love. He doesn't need to prove himself, you know? He doesn't need anybody's judgment to be passed on him. He's already accomplished greatness. Everything else is just cream. And I don't know if he feels that way. You know what I mean?
That is very interesting. You're probably right there, but that's really interesting. So, why don't we see if we can loop Christopher Barrett into this podcast?
Speaking of the cream of the crop.
Hello.
There he is right there, Chris.
Oh, that was quick.
We are here with Chris Barrett, reviews writer and interviewer for punknews.org.
How are we doing, guys? How are we doing tonight?
Good, Chris. We're pretty deep into this. Explain to the people your tardiness.
Yes. Why were you tardy?
There was this plate of ribs at this Chinese restaurant in Manhattan called Kanji Village. Now, these ribs, you don't understand. The shrimp paste that was just poured onto it, I couldn't pull myself away. I'm sorry. I couldn't pull myself away from the plate and get myself to the train station on time. So you can blame Kanji Village in Manhattan for my tardiness.
I think that is a fully justifiable reason for being late for this podcast.
Thank you. Pork is very important in my life.
Our brothers in PETA are not amused, but I'm cool. So just don't tell Rise Against that was your reason. No, fine.
I won't tell half the bands I listen to.
Yeah. Then that's cool. Now I'm hungry. So anyways, So we're talking about stuff.
Iced tea.
Yeah, we talked condoms. About iced tea for like 20 minutes.
There we go.
Yeah, why so not? That's
what. Wait, iced tea, the wrapper or iced
tea? No, the drink.
Oh, the drink.
Yeah.
Now I'm mad. Now I really should have pulled myself away from the plate of ribs.
You're going to have to wait and check it out with the rest of the world. So anyways, Chris, we're just going to keep going and keep talking about stuff now that you're here. So chime in as you will.
Yes.
So I think we're going to jump to the next piece of audio that we had that came up here. So Blacklisted posted a new video. The new video is really more or less just the song. The track is from their upcoming record, When People Grow, People Go. It's due out on the Death Wish Incorporated label on February 10th of 2015. The band last released the, I think it's the So Are You a Magician 7-inch back in 2012. So, or at least that's the last one that we reviewed. So it's been
That's the last release, yeah.
Is that the last release? Okay, yeah. So anyways, so it's been a little while since there's been new Blacklisted stuff. A lot of the hardcore people really like this band. Do you guys check this out?
Go on, Chris. Take it away.
Well, John, I was going to yield.
All right. Well, I'll talk about this. Blacklisted is what I would say a very modern. I mean, I know they've been around for a while now, but they exemplify modern hardcore. And when we say, I guess what we mean hardcore punk more than New York hardcore, although there's definitely influences of New York hardcore. Songs are very short, very hard. And also, with a lot of, you know, especially Death Wish style hardcore, the lyrics are very cerebral. It's not so much suicidal tendency like, you know, I'm crazy, I want to kill myself. Or even like, you know, like Cro-Mags, like, you know, the world's going to be destroyed. It's very, very thoughtful, I guess, if you could say. There's a great deal of poetry to the lyrics. That being said, you know, the song's short and hard like Adam likes, you know, a minute and a half. It's a banger. It doesn't really break any new ground, and I do appreciate that it is cerebral-type music, but I do wonder if in approaching things as the way, like, Converge that does, you know, or the way Blacklisted does, that in this cerebral explanation of things, or this almost very surrealist way of giving out lyrics, you do lose some of that initial snap of, you know, like, I want to kill myself, or, you know, I want to get revenge, or give me some more. It doesn't quite have that immediacy, because the lyrics require pondering. Not that that's worse, but it gives the music itself a different texture, you know. Whereas Cro-Mags, you know, are saying, you know, the world's going to be destroyed. Or whereas, you know, Reagan Youth is like, Hitler, you know, being Reagan Youth or, you know, or, you know, fascism or that kind of thing. Or even early F'd Up, where it's like, you know, the police are kicking down my door. You're like, yeah, the police are kicking down my door. Bam, 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 bam. Whereas a song like this, it's like there's not so much a chorus that has an immediate palpability to it that you can feel. You really have to think about it. And even that split second of thinking means that it generates a different reaction from you. That's my fundamental point. These lyrics are very poetic or, you know, very ambiguous. And so it creates a different reaction from the listener than lyrics where, like, the cops are kicking down my door, I hate the police.
That's interesting. I mean, that's a lot of the issue that I take with, not even issue, but the, sure, that's the issue that I seem to take with modern hardcore stuff, is that a lot of it seems to be a little bit more focused on the sound of it and the, you know, the interaction with the crowd that's going to come out of that song. But there's not a lot of, to me at least, there's not a lot of focus on bringing that rage around into like a chorus that I can identify later.
I agree.
And I mean, that's one of the reasons why I'm such a fan of a band like Career Suicide, where, yeah, they were playing like loud, short, fast songs. I mean, I would call them hardcore songs, but I'm sure someone would disagree with me there. But all those songs, you know, they seem to accumulate in, like, at least one little kind of, like, you know, chorus that I could glom onto in the middle of it. Bands like Blacklisted or even to some degree Painted Black, where, you know, they're playing these songs that, and I've seen them play live where the fans are so into them, but I'm just like, I'm missing a hook. And I get that this sounds awesome and looks awesome. But I always feel like I'm missing a hook.
That's so Adam, are you telling me that you don't like to study your lyrical content of music before you go to the concerts? That way you can practice, you can recite it. You just want accessibility. Is it about accessibility to you,
Adam? Yes, I am a busy person. I cannot study before going to a concert.
I guess that's why I love Ceremony, particularly Ronette Park. The lyrics are very thoughtful, very clever, but there's a great, you know, I'm sick of doo-doo-doo, I'm sick of doo-doo-doo, you know, or what is it, you know, open my head, open head, oh, you know, so it's thoughtful, but it has that immediate crack to it.
As someone who's a bad songwriter, myself, speaking of, as someone who's a bad songwriter, I would say it is... Actually, I feel like when you try and write a hook, like Adam's saying, you kind of go out on a limb and you're kind of seeing if it, because if it doesn't work, it just sounds weird, and you'll play it and maybe you'll get a weird reaction or somebody will say, well, why'd you choose to say that? Or what made you decide to use that? And I think if you're not making something catchy or you're not getting a hook to a song, it's in a way it's kind of easier because you're able to write to your own style, your own flow. But if you're trying to get something in there that you could kind of grasp onto, it's not as easy as it seems. I was never particularly good at doing it. So hence why I'm not in a band that's covered by punk news. But it's not as easy as it seems. So I understand why certain bands kind of shy away from it and kind of go more for, you know, something clever, something kind of where it kind of goes along. So I sort of understand why they wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Well, in case the listeners didn't know, the reason that Chris Barrett isn't covered by punk news and his band's not that hooky is he was in Coldplay, just so the listeners know.
I was a sound engineer for Coldplay for about 30 seconds. So, failed sound engineer, but, you know, next time. I'll get him next time, John.
That doesn't make you a member. It means you're a member of their crew.
Hey, listen, in my eyes and my heart, I was a member, okay?
You were like the fifth Beatle of Coldplay.
Do I still get a quarter of the mail that Ringo
Starr? I don't know. You're like the Pete West of Coldplay. I think that this actually plays into something that we talked about earlier on the show, Chris, which was we're talking about the fact that there's a lot more punk bands that are playing things that these days that seem to be less about the kind of like the upfront riffage, the upfront hook, and more about atmospherics. And this kind of like modern style of hardcore, to me at least, is in that vein. Like, does that kind of, like, John, does that kind of fit into what you were going at there?
Precisely.
Yeah, so, I don't know. This is just the We Are Old podcast, and we don't get what the kids are into. I don't necessarily think it's bad either. I mean, I guess that's the thing. This comes down to preference and maybe what we grew up with. But, like, I listen to a band like this, or even, like a lot of the Death Wish roster, Blacklist included, and I can listen to any of those bands, and I think to myself, like wow, like, I totally get why people like this, because, like, it's hard, and it's fast, and it's punishing, and it's awesome. But I can listen to, like, 400 of those songs and then kind of walk away and go, what? Like, I don't have anything. Like, I'm not grabbing onto anything except for, like, this general sense that, like, things were loud.
And to your point, Adam, I was just about to say, the thing I was looking for there was staying power. And I hate to say something like that, but I totally understand what you're saying, that it's not, you know, like you said, 400 songs. And it's like, oh, this is cool. But you feel like maybe you sat for 40 minutes and you listened to something, and then you kind of say, that was cool, but what did I listen to? As opposed to something sticking with you. It doesn't stick like it should. I mean, to certain people it does, but to other people, and I guess like you were saying, in terms of bands back in the day, which certain hooks that they used to have, you know, it stays with you, and also you can relate to it at a time and a place, whereas something maybe that the style that people are writing now, it doesn't quite stay. That it doesn't stay in the moment, and it might not have staying power in the future for you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, like it's funny because, like, I can go to shows that are hardcore shows and watch the bands and be totally entertained by what's going on, but I might not buy a record and walk out of there because I'm like, you know, like this was a thing where I wanted to see, you know, a bunch of guys going, you know, playing really hard, getting really crazy, jumping around with the crowd, you know, awesome stuff was happening. But I know if I go and I buy that 7-inch and I bring it home and I put it on at home, I'm not going to get the same thing out of it.
You're not getting that connection that you were hoping.
Yeah, but where I could, if it was a band that was, for I guess for lack of a better term, poppier, where they're playing something that was a little bit more like traditionally pop structured.
Okay,
I would say that there are some bands that are playing the, you know, the hooky, snappy, immediate stuff. I mean, this band Pears. I'm really coming around on this band Pears. I mean, that is some good modern hardcore. Adam, have you heard Pears?
I haven't, but everyone's been talking about.
They're Pears. Pretty cool. When I first heard them, I thought this is okay. This is not great. The more I listen to it, the more I dig it. You know, it is, you know, thoughtful lyrics, but it's very immediate. Very, I guess. for back of it, it's kind of more West Coasty lyrically. You know, the lyrics are a little bit more direct, but they're clever as well. I'm digging Pears. So let's talk about some old school stuff quick. Teenage Time Killer has announced that they've signed with Rise Records. You say, John, who's Teenage Time Killer? First of all, they're a band named after Rudimentary Peni. That's how you get points in John's book, let me tell you. It's being led by two guys of Corrosion of Conformity, Mike Dean and Reed Mullen, and no one's exactly sure what it's going to be, but it appears that they're recording the music and they're going to have a bunch of guest vocalists. Guest vocalists that have been announced that are going to be on it are going to be a lot of people. Randy Blythe, Dave Grohl, who also recorded it, Bill Stevenson mastered this, Corey Taylor, Jello Biafra, Lee Ving of Fear, Tommy Victor of Danzig and Prong, Nick Oliveri, Pete Stahl, Vic Bondi of Articles of Faith, Clifford Dinsmore, Max Calavera of Sepultura, Tony Farista of Iron Reagan, and what's the other band?
Municipal Waste.
Doyle of the Misfits. So they got a star-studded roster. Disclaimer, Keith Morris has been listed in all the news stories as being on this, but he said on his Facebook that he is not on it at all. Just an FYI. I was thinking about doing an article saying he's not on it, but that seems vindictive. When I don't think he's vindictive, I think he's just trying to clarify. You know what I mean? Like, if I did a big article that said Keith Morris not in Teenage Time Killer, that would be, like, I don't, weird, right? Or not weird, but, like, creating controversy where there really is none.
Yeah, I get that.
So the question is, though,
it opens the door for you to write stories like Keith Morris not in We Were Promised Jetpacks. Yeah. Keith Morris not in Lost Love. Keith Morris not in Kicker.
So this looks cool, but the question is this too much?
It's been done. I'm pretty sure for a while, Bullet Treatment, I think the last two 7-inches, which are the guys from Suicidal Tendencies, I believe, Bullet Treatment had two 7-inches.
Bullet Treatment is Suicidal Tendencies?
Am I wrong? I'm almost 95% sure that there's at least two of the guys from Suicide Tendencies.
You look that up. I'm gonna look into this. I didn't know that. I've got the first 7-inch.
Well, the early stuff, I think they had a permanent vocalist, and then they put out an LP with I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name. The singer of the Bronx. I'm blanking on his name right now. I'm sorry. I know I should know it. But he did one or two LPs with them, and then he left, and then they put out two 7-inches later, which had there were 6-song 7-inches, and each 7-inch had different vocalists for each song. Yeah, yeah. Dave Hildaga, it's something I've seen before, and I'm sure it's been done before that too.
Dave Grohl actually did it with his is it Probot or Crobot?
Yeah, I was just about to mention Probot, which is that metal project that he released. What was it? Late 2000s?
No, I think like late 2000s, mid 2000s.
Late 2000s, 2007. That thing came out where, you know, he went and he put together like a bunch of metal songs, and he had like all these various guest vocalists from all these various, you know, metal bands.
But the problem with that is it was too much. Like, some of the tracks were banging, but some of them were just boring. But you get no flow. It just sounds like a bunch of singles that kind of go together, you know? I kind of think that you need at least a recurring vocalist throughout, or a few recurring vocalists, to really make something cohesive. Otherwise, it starts up and then it stops. It starts up and then it stops. It doesn't keep going. That's my only problem. I mean, I'm definitely going to get this, but that's my main concern with these kind of projects.
I don't know where I'm going. I agree with you there. That these kind of things, they always feel a little bit hit and miss for me, because there's they're interesting from like this is a curio, right? But it's not something that has a lot of consistency.
What I would love to see is like maybe two or three vocalists, you know, maybe one guy's on one track, maybe two guys are on another track, maybe all three are on another track. You know, almost like I would love to hear a punk rock version of Dr. Dre's The Chronic. Not a cover of The Chronic, but the way Dr. Dre approached The Chronic. You know, he's the main guy, he creates most of the music, but then he has different vocalists come and go on it. But he has a few vocalists that stay on it throughout. You know, Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, and also, is it Daz F? No, it's Corrupt, who's on it a lot, too. So even though, you know, people come and go and circle back around, you have a consistent theme or consistent stream that keeps the momentum within the release. I would love to see that in a punk rock release.
These things could also be done. I mean, I could see a record like this, or even that Probot record, done a little bit more interestingly as, say,
singles.
Well, not even singles, but like let's say like as a series of either like 7-inch singles or EPs.
Yeah, like what if they did an EP with like each guy? That'd be cool.
Yeah, it? Right. Where it's all part of the same project. Everyone like it's obvious. Like this is like Probot Volume 5, the one with Lemmy, right, or something like that. And you got Lemmy on for a couple tracks, and then you have like Probot Volume 6, and it's the one with like King Diamond or whatever, right? Like you can do. I think like that sort of thing would lead to more, I don't know, to more interest. I don't know. To me, that's a more interesting way of releasing it than just to dump all of those people onto one record. But
yeah, you know. Yeah, Punk News would never do anything like that. Dump a whole bunch of people onto a record.
Nah.
So anyway, let's wrap this up. Let's talk about Devo. Everybody loves Devo. Devo's putting out a new DVD. It's going to be called Hardcore Live, and it's a live filming from their Oakland, California show from earlier this year, where they played a whole bunch of songs and only songs written before their first album. So songs from the first album and songs from before the first album that never made it onto any Devo DVD. This tour did not come to Philadelphia. It did come to Baltimore. I didn't go. I should have went. This looks really cool. What was neat is during the show is Devo is always very artistic, and they had a very neat theme for the show. Is during the show, the background would change as they grew and as a band. Like it's like the background starts out as a garage, no, a basement. Then it becomes a garage. Then it becomes like a small club. So the background constantly changes, and so do they. Almost like a Gwar or Niles Cooper show to go along with the history of the song, which I thought was super cool.
Mm-hmm. I'd actually really like to hear this. The accompanying video where they kind of introduce the whole concept, if you weren't familiar with the tour that came out, is pretty intriguing in that, you know, here's a band with a ton of history, with a ton of, you know, with a lot of acclaim, and they're going back and they're playing their, you know, they're re-embracing the stuff that they did prior even to their first full length. And there's one comment that's in the video that really stuck with me, which is someone said that you could see people in the crowd basically like ticking songs off their bucket list that they never thought they would hear this band play. And I think that's kind of a neat way to think of it. So, yeah, this is – I mean, and it fits with the whole, like, de-evolving thing, right? We're going to go back and play our earliest shit.
Right. Whatever gets hardcore fans excited. I wondered if there were people in the crowd who were just there to see them play Whip It.
There were. Apparently, it was, like, a big bummer for the show. Like, mm-hmm. I heard multiple reports of, like, you know, just drunk jackasses. And even drunk jackasses that knew Devo would just, like, yell out the hits. And this was a non-hits tour, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, so.
Adam, you have a dog
toy? It's tough because if you
it's
have.
Not me.
Oh, I'm sorry?
Go ahead, Chris.
I'm sorry. That's my dog toy that you're hearing. I'm sorry about that.
Chris is actually made out of springs, and he needs oil.
Yeah, I was rotating my shoulder, and it sounded like a squeaky toy, but I'll get that fixed up for you. So, I'd imagine, any hardcore fan of Devo would be impressed by, you know, what they staged for the tour. But in terms of someone just, like John was saying, drunk jackasses in the back who just want to listen to one song. Oh, I wanted to hear that one song. They could say they saw it live. And, you know, I mean, you don't want to have to stand in a crowd with that. But inevitably with bands that do have that one hit, you're going to get that. So for the most part, I would hope that if someone went and enjoyed that didn't take away from that in terms of what would happen.
And just to wrap this up is Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo is a super interesting guy. Like in the punk rock world or the music world, it's like, oh, yeah, he's Devo. And maybe he does some other things too. We're not sure. In the film score world, he's like a super famous film scorer. And like, oh, yeah, Mark Mothersbaugh, I think he does music or something. But then in the visual art world, he's super famous for his sculptures. And they're like, oh, that famous sculptor, Mark Mothersbaugh, I think he does music or something. Like, he's got three – he has been wildly successful in three separate areas, and none of them significantly overlap with the other, which is crazy. If you go and look up what films that Mark Mothersbaugh have scored, it'll blow your mind. Like, films that you love and enjoy that you don't realize that he scored. It's crazy. Like he did the Lego movie, for example.
Yeah, there you go. I think we're done. I have anything to go with that. We keep walking in the corners here.
Listen, he did Pee Wee. He did Rugrats. He did Beakman's World. He did Dumb and Dumber. He did Bottle Rocket. He did, let's see what else here, Crash Bandicoot 2. He did Rushmore. He did the Lego Movie. He did Hawaii Vacation. He did so many. I mean, Royal Tenenbaums. So many more. It's just insane.
I am sold simply on Crash Bandicoot 2.
Well, there you go.
I like that Crash Bandicoot 2 came more notably in your list than Royal Tenenbaums.
Well, yeah. the reason it is because he doesn't seem to have any pretentiousness. Like, if they ask him to do Royal Tenenbaums, he'll do it. If they want him to do Super Smash Brothers 7, he'll do it, you know? So that's what I appreciate about Mark Mothersbaugh. He's up for a challenge. He's not scared of any format, be a cheesy video game or hoity-toity movie.
Yeah, can't argue with that.
That's so. Like punk news. We're not scared. We'll talk about punk rock, be it cerebral or be it straight up banging.
Or we'll talk about, you know, new Kirby game that's coming out on Nintendo.
Well, there you go. Chris Barrett, thank you for being on the Punk News Podcast, as always. And Adam White, always with your super insight, always talking about
Ice tea
and hardcore and how we dissect them. Thank you for being here tonight.
You don't know how upset I am that I missed that iced tea conversation.
It was pretty good.
I blame the damn ribs.
Well, listen, if you want to hear us talk more about iced tea or any other beverage, write us at podcast@punknews.org. So think that over. Think about what beverage you want us to talk about next, and we'll see you next week.